that either feeling just pure love or having a joyful laugh is actually a way to turn on your immune system. So we're healed today here too, all right? So I'd like first of all to introduce Ed Snow, who is a practicing lawyer, or he likes to say he's a recovering lawyer. And maybe he quit, but no, that doesn't mean what recovering lawyer means. He's a resolved, he says, or repentant lawyer. He's married, has three children. He has a book out at the book table called Book of Curious Workmanship, Musings on Things Mormon. It's a signature book that you might want to take a look at out there. He's also the current editor for Eriantum, which is an association for Mormon letters and literary. It's a literary magazine. We would like to welcome him today here. He will be then following him. There will be our respondent. The very esteemed Matt Workman will then follow him.
And what I've done today is I've taken two different pieces and kind of melded them together. The piece, the Strengthening the Member Sense of Humor Committee, is kind of a more theoretical piece on humor, and I've kind of gutted that because I've given it about four times in the last year, and it's a little bit, some parts were stale for me, and so I added this other piece, which is actually a humor piece, so it's kind of mixing theory and practice together, and hopefully they will flow together in some way. 6 months into my mission, I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. Nibbly. He knew everything, he wrote with style, and through it all bore a fervent testimony. I had learned that Brother Nibbly read nearly every book in the Berkeley Library, so upon returning to BYU after my mission, in order to imitate my hero, I decided to do the same, except on a more modest scale. I went to the Mormon Studies section of the BYU Library, and lifted every book on the shelves, read a few of them, and took a lot of notes, and started writing. By the time I finished my junior year at BYU, I submitted a paper to Farms comparing Meroitic Egyptian hieroglyphs to the Anthon transcript. And that was the Anthon transcript that Mark Hoffman discovered. In those days, every morning as I rolled out of bed, I repeated myself, "Happy is the man who finds his life's work." This was a quote I'd memorized from Nietzsche, I thought, or maybe Proust or Plato or maybe even Elvis, and I couldn't remember, but I was happy at the time. I was happy, that is, until Farms rejected my paper. I was stunned. When I complained to my roommate about my misfortune, he patted me on the shoulder and, to console me, he said, "Ed, let's face it. You know a mere smattering of ancient history, even less about ancient languages, and you're not too smart. You're an English major, for crying out loud. No one is ever going to take you seriously. Get over it and go to law school." And so I took his advice. During law school at the University of Tennessee, I managed to hang on to my dream to defend the faith by magnifying my church callings. I taught the 12 and 30-year-old lessons during Sunday school, which was an experience in self-defense at any rate, and I also taught the elders' quorum lesson, which was actually a position akin to that of referee. And thanks to a kind institute director, I was allowed, in spite of my sophomoric antics and outbursts, to teach the LDS Institute on campus. But the urge to do something really profound and make an enduring contribution to Mormon letters, not just to teach, itched inside of me. I soon discovered a poetic vein in my wrists, attributable no doubt to my relation to Eliza R. Snow. Our lines cross genealogically a generation before Adam. So I let flow into some very bad and moody Mormon poetry. And after law school, I continued to write poetry as a young practicing attorney, finding that the whereas clauses I wrote in contracts for bank clients actually helped my writing style for a period, made it more precise, more classical, or at least more Latinate. And with my brow knotted and brooded in verse at the wee hours of the night, I felt very significant. Until I read one day that more people actually write poetry than read it. For a time, my case burned with betrayal, as I suffered like Job. My testimony was shaken. Why would an all-powerful, all-loving God make me suffer by instilling in me an overwhelming desire to write something that no one will ever read, not even my mother, willingly? In desperation, I turned to writing short stories. I discovered to write stories about people who were poets and apologists. And that way I could still write the poetry and theology I'd struggled to write earlier, just under the pseudonym of one of my characters. And since the short story market was bigger than the poetry market, this seemed like the ideal vehicle. I was soon practicing in Baltimore, married and teaching gospel doctrine. I'd even sent some stories and poetry to independent Mormon journals, but prepared myself for those inevitable rejection letters that you're warned about in the books you read when you want to write. And I'm sure many of you know the titles of some of these books on how to write fiction. Some of them have titles like Drawing on the Author Inside of You and Plagiarizing His Work, or Using Verbs and Nouns to Make Your Writing Live. Some of them have a genre focus: write romance novels while you sleep. I figured if I could publish a few stories, it might justify the issuance of a short story collection. And before I knew it, I'd be on my way toward a best-selling novel in the yet-to-be-recognized genre of Mormon apologist, poet, action, mystery, thrillers. Thankful that a stupor of thought was better than no thought at all, I continued writing. At the same time, I began writing a personal essay column for AML List, which is an online listserv relating to Mormon literature. Thinking that writing some nonfiction would be kind of a cross-training exercise for writing fiction. And my column consisted of ruminations over outtakes from my gospel doctrine class at church. It just so happened that as I was searching for faith-promoting materials for my class, I kept coming across really curious and weird stuff that I couldn't really fit into my lessons, and so I wrote about them. And just as Jack Welch at Farms discovered undiscovered chiastic Hebrew poetry hidden in the pages of the Book of Mormon, I felt I had discovered undiscovered veins of humor hidden in the pages of Mormon history, scripture, and practice. I soon fancied myself a kind of Mormon humor archaeologist. My columns became defenses, as the Greeks called them, apologies, for the existence of Mormon humor. I was now taking seriously the fact that no one took me seriously. I was turning, as the Book of Mormon tells us, my weakness into my strength. Following in the footsteps of earlier Mormon humor pioneers, I had finally found my life's work, convinced an unbelieving world that there is indeed something funny about Mormonism. I forgot about poetry, short stories, or novels, and finally convinced Signature Books to gamble on a collection of my essays, titled Of Curious Workmanship, Musings on Things Mormon. My goal with this book is to sell enough copies to cover my tithing expenses. Now, I've talked with my accountant, and this is entirely possible to cover my tithing expenses with the sale of this book if I can get my income down to about $5,000 a year. And recently, as if in confirmation of my newfound calling of Mormon humor apologist, Elder Faust up and writes a first presidency message in the March Ensign entitled The Need for Balance in Our Lives. Did anyone read that? The message is mainly about humor in the first presidency message. That may be a first. Now, you have to promise not to tell anyone, but I've heard from my secret source in Salt Lake City that this article that Elder Faust wrote was written in order to prepare the church for two confidential forthcoming developments. Number one, the establishment of the Strengthening the Members of Humor Committee. And number two, the calling of Ward and Stake humorists. The Strengthening the Members of Humor Committee, according to my source, among other things, will be responsible for keeping files on members who don't have a sense of humor and reporting them to their stake presidents. The ward humorist will be required to attend PEC meetings and other meetings and sit next to the bishop and crack wise most of the time. The ward humorist will also be responsible for providing resources for ward members to make talks, lessons, and meetings more amusing. Of course, the stake humorist will conduct training meetings every quarter for ward humorists and provide humor for stake-level activities. Perhaps the stake humorist could also orchestrate a stake-wide program for providing laugh tracks during high counselor talks. The ward humorists and stake humorists will also be responsible for interacting on the local level with the media and conducting PR initiatives. And here's a recent episode that occurred in Minnesota that could have used the assistance of an inspired stake humorist. Humorist Roy Blunt wrote an essay recently and talked about a baptism joke he did on the radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. And here's the joke that Mr. Blunt told on that radio show. It's between two good old boys, and it goes something like this. Ralph says, "Do you believe in infant baptism?" And Fred says, "Believe in it? Hell, I've seen it done." This joke set off a chain of emails on the Prairie Home Companion website from members of several different denominations, including a Minnesota Mormon. The LDS listener responded as follows, and this is her email or his email. This Minnesota Mormon, Mormons don't believe in infant baptism either, thought that the joke was very funny. Mormons also believe in baptism by immersion, not sprinkling, and in baptism for the dead, by proxy that is. Please don't flip out. And here's a Mormon joke. Did you hear that the Catholics have started practicing nepotism for the dead? Yes. They just installed a new lawn sprinkler in their cemetery. The Minnesota Mormon concluded her email or his email by stating, "An outsider would definitely not get this joke." And then Mr. Blunt warned the reader of his essay, "We can't, of course, generalize from this statement that all Mormons pride themselves on their own humor's obscurity." Now, if I had been the stake humorist in that Minnesota stake, I would have diffused the still delicate controversy by issuing a simple and short press release, something along the following lines. In order to fully understand this Mormon joke, people would really need to speak with missionaries from the church, who would be more than happy to explain it to you over the course of 7 short lessons. But at the risk of giving you a simplistic answer, I will note that baptism sounds a lot like nepotism, a Catholic historical practice, but not peculiar to Catholics. In fact, the early Mormon practice of adoption, that is, for instance, you could be adopted as the son of Brigham Young or Joseph Smith, this was discontinued later, this early practice of adoption was the true doctrine of nepotism for the dead. The only guidelines for such press releases is to be careful not to explain humor too much, because dissection usually kills its subjects. Now, Garrison Keillor of the Prairie Home Companion show has suggested in his Lutheran context that God, quote, writes a lot of comedy. The trouble is God is stuck with so many bad actors who don't know how to play the scenes. Now, Mormons, as compared to Lutherans, being the true and living church, claim that we know how to play the scenes. But it is the job of the Strengthening the Member Sense of Humor Committee and ward and stake humorists to make sure that these scenes are translated correctly. With a proper translation, I am convinced 80% of Mormon history and experience can be amusing. Ward and stake humorists will magnify their callings by giving the saints the necessary translation skills. And in fact, very recently I understand that there has been established a Mormon Humor Translation Subcommittee of the member Strengthening the Member Sense of Humor Committee. And in fact, I have submitted to them a brief task paper, which I'd like to read to you now. And it is a translation of ordinary Mormon history and experience into Mormon humor. Afterwards, I welcome any questions about the translation process, as well as any comments on how to make the translation more accessible. And now's when I do this kind of crazy second paper. It's called Baptized Chickens, Praying Dogs, and Birds of Writing the History of Pets and Other Animals in Mormondom. Peculiar among Christians, Mormons believe that animals have spirits and will rise in the resurrection. Because of this doctrine, I find it strange that no one has yet written a history of pets and other animals as a part of the Mormon experience. This essay is an attempt to break ground into this new area of Mormon studies. I have collected the following Mormon animal anecdotes in the hope that future Mormon animal historians will have a foundation from which to write more comprehensive studies in the field I call Mormanimal history. One of my first Mormanimal experiences was in the mission field. We were teaching a gentleman the first discussion sitting on a park bench. My companion held the flip chart as he discussed ancient prophets and flipped to the page where Isaiah is sitting, writing on a scroll as two witnesses look over his shoulder. I nodded at appropriate times and directed my attention to the flip chart in accordance with missionary policy. Suddenly, without warning, Isaiah's head and my companion's hand were splattered with something that looked like globs of squirted chalky white paint and a little black and green spilled on top. Suspecting sabotage by Jehovah's Witnesses, I glanced around only to discover our assailant, a pigeon, landing a couple of yards away on the ground. As I looked back again, my companion had changed hands and flipped to the next page without missing a beat in his presentation. We looked at our investigator, who, much to my relief, was asleep. Then it was my turn, so I took the flip chart and banged it against the bench, stirring the gentleman, and proceeded to finish our presentation. In companionship study the next day, we puzzled and pondered over this incident. I pointed out that a dove, which looked like a pigeon except dressed perhaps in temple clothes or Sunday best, was of course a holy symbol, the scriptures referencing doves. My companion then turned to that handy reference that has launched 1,000 2.5-minute talks. No, not Mormon doctrine, but Webster's Dictionary. We found an entry for dove that's something like this. A dove is a kind of bird with short legs, a small head, and a thick body which makes a cooing noise. We were satisfied with that definition. We turned to pigeon. Pigeon was defined as something like a bird of the dove family. And this concerned us. We puzzled and pondered why a member of the dove family might poop upon our presentation. I have never admitted this before, but for the first time in my life, this incident caused me to entertain the idea that maybe, just maybe, some of that anti-Mormon literature was right, and we might be a satanic cult, and this pigeon may have sent us a message from God. Then my companion cleared my stupor of thought by suggesting if a pure white dove in Palestine symbolized the Holy Ghost, it only made sense that a mangy gray dove in Basel, Switzerland symbolized the anti-Holy Ghost. Although not found expressly in the scriptures, we were satisfied with this interpretation, and we replaced the afflicted page in our flip chart. We took to calling pigeons birds of perdition after that. Of course, not all birds in Mormon history have been anti-Mormon animals. The seagull, rightfully so, is permanently nested as a hero in Mormon history because of its act of binging and purging, and more binging and purging, on crickets to save the Mormon pioneer crops. These gulls are the Danites of the bird family, literally chewing up and spitting out the enemies of the kingdom. Yet I think there's a side to this story that has not been properly appreciated, and if you'll pardon me for being a slightly revisionist historian, I'm convinced if this miracle happened today, that LDS Social Services would be available to assist these birds in overcoming their eating disorders and focusing on less personally destructive ways to eliminate crickets. Now, I'm sure many of you will be wondering how it is I can claim that there's any such thing as a history of Mormon animals, when in fact, there are no church records of any baptized animals. I figured there'd be some cranks like you out there, and I'm prepared for your objections. I think we're all ready to accept the fact nowadays that Mormonism is more than just a denomination, it's a subculture as well. And our subculture has room enough in it for animals, even if they aren't official members of the Mormon Church. In fact, let me demonstrate with one last chicken anecdote why baptizing animals at this stage in Mormon history may not be appropriate anyway. Hiram Ploss, who was the president of my old student branch at the University of Tennessee, told us this story one Sunday, for reasons that escape me, and it has made a lasting impression on me. As a child, Brother Ploss learned one Sunday in Sunday school that everyone had to be baptized to enter into the celestial kingdom. Now, as he pondered this new doctrine, it occurred to him his 7 or 8 chickens he had cooped up at home had not been baptized. So after church that day, he went straight home, and like St. Francis of Assisi, he preached the gospel to these birds, and being literally minded than St. Francis, he commenced baptizing them, unsuccessfully. In his adult years, I think he came to realize animals are like children who haven't reached the age of accountability. They don't need baptism. I trust this incident should quiet my critics. In addition to birds, dogs also play a significant role in Mormon history and in the Mormon experience. It's fairly well known, for instance, that Joseph Smith had a dog accompany him during the trek of Zion's camp. Apparently, this dog was not possessed of the gift of discernment. He could not tell friend from foe and tried to bite everyone. Many people apostatize from the church because of this dog. I suspect this dog received his calling to be Joseph's pet. How did J. Golden Kimball used to say it? He was to be Joseph's pet not to inspire the people, but to test them. And I had pet dogs growing up as well, although none of them so disagreeable as Joseph's. And like Brother Ploss, as a child, I also had difficult experiences trying to teach my pets to be good Mormons. Growing up, my driveway was a favorite basketball court in our neighborhood. My friends would often bring their basketballs and their dogs to come over to my house to shoot basketball with me. My dog was named Honey, and was just like that dog named Skip that was in the movies, and she used to play football and basketball with us, except she was better at football. And it finally got so that Honey realized he was not very good at basketball, and she would stop trying to play with us and just hang out with the other dogs at the side of the court and watch us play. On one occasion, the dogs got bored with our game. And this is a difficult experience for me to relate to you, but I'll go ahead. Some of the dogs instigated some promiscuous activities with my own dog, Honey. There she was, engaging in dog fornication, right in front of our eyes. Maybe it was her way of getting attention now that she no longer played basketball with us, or perhaps it was a cry for help. But you can imagine how embarrassed I was, me, the Mormon, whose own dog was supposed to be setting an example. Well, I have to confess, at first I tried to ignore it, pretend it wasn't happening. But it got so bad I had to do something. Finally, I ran over to the garage, grabbed the water hose, and let them have it. We only had to use the water hose a couple of times after that, and the problem corrected itself. Now, I know other pet owners might have tried different methods of handling this delicate situation, but this one worked, and no dog was worse for the wear. Chastity is a difficult principle to teach and sometimes requires extraordinary measures. Think about it. If every time you walk into the room, your frisky dog grabs hold of your leg in an attempt to vent some frustrations, are you going to calmly sit your dog down in front of you, correct its behavior while speaking in reassuring tones, remove spicy foods from its diet, and suggest that it sleep on its stomach? No, heck no. You're going to go for the water hose. Now, when my own children reach dating age someday and I catch them smooching and hugging on the back porch or in the car at the end of the driveway, and I'm not going to commit to it right now, but I may, at that future time, have to bring this disciplinary technique out of retirement. Now, later as a missionary, I had additional dog encounters that deserve notice in the annals of Mormon history. One occasion, while going door to door, we walked up a set of stairs about 30 steps high after passing a sign that said, "Beware of dog." As we knocked on the door, we could hear barking that sounded like a train in the distance that keeps getting closer. When the door opened, we watched in amazement as a very large, barking dog ran across the foyer of the house, out the door, and then lunged at my arm, its open, snarling mouth ready to rip my arm from its socket. As I recall, I quickly yanked my arm to the square in order to cast the demon out of the dog. Just in time for the dog to miss my arm, tumble head over paws down the steps, and slide on its chin across the driveway at the bottom. The remarkable thing I still remember is the Doppler effect made by the dog as it barked its way past us and down the steps. Now, not one to waste exorcisms unnecessarily, I put my arm back into my coat pocket. My companion and I then pretended nothing had happened and told the lady at the door that we had a message for families. She said she didn't have a family, unless you counted her dog. The dog by this time had whimpered off behind the bushes somewhere. We said we weren't particular and could tailor our message to fit her needs. It seems to me that she and her dog broke our next appointment. Now, by these anecdotes, I'm not suggesting that all dogs are Jack Mormons, like Joseph's, or anti-Mormons, like this dog I met on my mission, or Mormons needing to be called to repentance, like my own dog, Honey. Each of us, of course, knows many dogs who are active, respectable Mormons. Take the dog owned by a family I used to home teach, the Normans. This was one orthodox dog, an iron rotter if there ever was one. On my first visit to the Normans, I gave the closing prayer. As I folded my arms, the dog woke up from sleeping, rolled over onto its belly, and lay attentively, its front legs folded. At the end of the prayer, we all said amen, and the dog looked up at the ceiling and barked once with the rest of the family. They all followed me, including the dog, to the front door. Dog repeated this performance at every home teaching visit thereafter. And this is a true story. I only wish my own kids could perform that religiously. Dogs are also a part of the Missouri Mormon experience, as I'm sure you're aware. J. Golden Kimball claimed once that Brigham Young said, "The western boundaries of the state of Missouri will be swept so clean of its inhabitants that when we return to Missouri, there will not be as much as a yellow dog to wag his tail." Now, according to some of my confidential Salt Lake City sources, an elderly couple recently went on a hush-hush mission back to Missouri, which is called the Yellow Dog Mission, to monitor the Jackson County yellow dog population and report quarterly to someone in Salt Lake. This confidential source reports an additional rumor that the Mormon Alliance has founded a sister association, which is called the Mormon Animal Alliance, kind of a Mormon animal rights activist group with the purpose to monitor the monitoring of yellow dogs by the Yellow Dog Mission in Missouri. As I understand it, the Mormon Animal Alliance suspects the Yellow Dog Mission is really attempting to either deport yellow dogs from Missouri in order to hasten the coming of the millennium, or perhaps excommunicate Mormons owning yellow dogs. On the other hand, the Yellow Dog Mission suspects the Mormon Animal Alliance of importing yellow dogs into the state of Missouri in order to postpone millennial activity. They also suspect the Mormon Animal Alliance of collecting case reports of individuals who were excommunicated for owning yellow dogs. Time limitations will not let me discuss other animals in Mormondom, such as Jonah's whale, Balaam's ass, Sidney Rigdon's snake, Deseret, which by interpretation means polyandrous bees, the Bear Lake monster, Bigfoot slash Cain, salamanders, Nauvoo's pigs, and even John Taylor's singing mouse, which was a proto Stuart Little. No, I must leave these Mormon animals to others to study and their stories to tell, hoping someday, after lions have rested next to lambs in the millennium, after serpents have gotten their legs back in the resurrection, and after all cats have been redeemed from hell, after that we will better understand Mormon animals' place, both historically and theologically. Thank you very much.
All right, what I just did there, that was my impersonation of a testimony that's going to go too long. No, and but that's the warning sign. It's like 5 minutes to the hour, and they say, testimonies will end at 4 minutes to the hour. And then the guy gets up, and I understand the demographics here. You'll pardon me, please. Generally an elderly gentleman. And gets up. Grabs the side, like, he's like, he knows that maybe he's going to try to pull him away, so he's ready for him. And then he looks down, and the rest of the audience goes, oh, no. We're going to, I hope you pack a lunch, because you're going to be here a while. I had this happen to me, literally. The guy just said flat out, the bishop can't stop me from bearing my testimony no matter what time it is. Honest, I mean, which is the Mormon equivalent of saying, I'm flying this plane to Cuba. Like, he'd hijacked us. He had hijacked our afternoon. It was, and he went 30 minutes. And what did I was going to go home. And nope, you listen to me. Which is why I, you know, I think my, so we need a gong. And we need a gong to take, you know, because there's some, I mean, there's nothing wrong with testimonies. I'm all for them. But, you know, time, things get long, and sometimes people do, when I first moved to Los Angeles, a woman, the first sentence was, and this is serious, my first Sunday in Los Angeles, it was a testimony meeting, maybe that's not the way to get introduced to Los Angeles. She said, I believe they crucify me every day. And I immediately began thinking about how unpacked am I? and went on at one point to explain, and again, this, I'm not making this up. She said, you know that God created America and everything in it. But then he handed it over to ungodly people, you know, like the phone company. Needless to say, my mind raced to that solemn assembly where God handed the keys to America over to the phone company. And but it wasn't a very spiritual experience I was having. And as a matter of fact, like so many crying children, I had to excuse myself to the foyer where I could laugh. But this would have been a great time for the gong, you see. Because you could have the gong and say, like, one representative of each of the auxiliaries of the ward, you know, have the priest of the Relief Society, even, where the deacon's quorum's not going to be up there. But have all of them, and then when something like a phone company crack comes, bong, isn't gong, that's TO, timeout. And the bishop can go,
okay, Sister Johnson, why did you gong Sister Smith?
And then she would have to, you know, you can't just gong them and, you know, be done. You have to give your reason, you know. So,
well, my dad worked for the phone company, and he's a temple worker, and, you know, I don't think he's from Satan.
Fair enough. Next testimony.
And, you know, and you go on. And, you know, so, and we need gong. I want also and this is, you know, this is Los Angeles. We might have some industry here, so you might, I'll explain the terminology there. We need maybe a floor director for all sacrament meetings would be good for this. And for those of you not familiar, floor director works generally on the set of a television show, especially live broadcasts, you know, like talk shows or news programs. And he gives like little cues for things. When there's like 2 minutes left, he does that. And when there, you know, when there's 30, you know, he gives you a countdown and, you know, cut it off and stuff like that. So the floor director would have a seat right there, and the speaker, you know, because the thing is, when the bishop wants you to shut up, he's back there, and you can't see him, you know. And he, I mean, the rest of the audience sees him, congregation, excuse me. Oh, wow, Freudian flip. you know, the congregation can see the bishop getting nervous and kind of going, but he can't, he's going. So you got the floor director there, he gives you, like, you got 2 minutes, you got 1 minute, cut it off, you know. And then if he doesn't, he cues the piano player, who would begin softly playing "In the Hollow of Thy Hand," and that's, you know, cue. Oh, our time's up here. I'm gonna wrap this up now. And you got 30 seconds of "In the Hollow of Thy Hand." And if you don't come through, then the floor director would cut to a special musical number, something rousing like "Call to Serve" or "In Our Lovely Deseret" or something like that. And that's going to go until the man sits down. And I feel that way. I'm offering a proposal now. And if you follow me. Oops. That was almost heresy there. I'm sorry. I retract. I'm a lawyer. Where'd you go? Strike that. Cool. Okay.
Objection.
Withdrawn. And but I think with a gong and a floor director, I think, you know, we could increase spirituality in our ward. And I tell you this today because I do a lot of stand-up now, but it's for non-Mormon audiences, generally. The Mormons aren't the types that frequent comedy clubs very often. We're not the wacky people. We want to think we're Jewish, But where are the great Mormon comics? They're not as silly, generally. So and I found that generally there's a lot that's funny about being Mormon, more so if you're not Mormon. You know, that's what's really funny. Is not being Mormon. Like, ha, I'm not you. Your church has that law of chastity, doesn't it? You're 30, aren't you? You're not married, are you? Nope. And that's a problem, because let me tell you this much. You know, you can say what you want about homosexuality being an unnatural sexual act, but try celibacy, man. That is unnatural. That is something you're not built to do, trust me, I can tell you. Strike that. This is the rudest thing I've ever done. Oh. This is not part of what I'm supposed to do. I'm just got really... I didn't see that. See, if you might all want to come up here later on, but this is a car, and there's some blind spots, and they go to about there. I can't see anything there. It's where the glass is, right there. So I'm so, my mother raised me better than this. I'm so sorry. Thanks. But because I'm thinking, I mean, a lot of the celibacy thing is self-mastery. You're going to learn self-mastery. But I think that by the time you've turned 30, you've proven your point. You know, you've proven what you can do. And you should get a voucher or something, like your 30th birthday, just a gift, like a way to go. You've made it to 30. Have one on us. You've been good. We've had interviews every year with you, and you haven't even bent the rules, so just, you know, you've earned it. If anyone on this planet has earned it, you have. Go with God. But there are rumors in Mormon singles circles that they actually do that. They don't. Not even if you ask. They won't. They'll look at you weird, and then it's the ward fellowshipping committee over at your house. You don't want that. I've also having difficulty, you know, because you're a comic, you got a material, you got to do stuff, and I have a girlfriend now. And I'm losing all my material. They talk about social frustration. That's gone. The whole desperate thing. If it goes much further, I lose all my married material. Making fun of married people. And the virginity thing will go too. And I got nothing. I have no more material past that. The worst thing that could happen to me is if I won the lottery or something like that. Now I'm not even poor. There's nothing. There's. I will cease to exist on that day. There will be no more Matt. But well, that was kind of a disturbing. I'll just put that there. All right. So this is weird. Like, I feel like I'm in church. Like, this is not the general stand-up format here. Generally, you're open, and you guys are in the dark. I can't see you. So you can, if everything stinks, you can feel free to do that, and then I have freedom of movement. But this is like I feel like I should be telling you, like how our how your stock portfolio did, you know.
Well, the Nasdaq crashed a few weeks ago, but don't worry, we put our money in Cuban futures. It's good.
But instead, we have. Feel very rigid. So anyhow, I want to share with you what happens when I stray from Mormon material in a normal audience. I was invited to perform at a club, and invited to perform in a club by a friend of mine, and showed up, and as is often the case sometimes on weekdays, show up at the time, there's nobody there at all. So me and this other guy just started messing around. Like, I just got up and did stuff for my friend, he got up and did stuff, and while he was up, the place slowly filled up until it was pretty full. And so so then after a while, he sees that there's enough people in there. He says, I want to introduce my good friend, Matt Workman. Brings me out. I go out there, and I'm on the stage, am now the only white guy in the whole room. And I figured, I don't want to go with the Mormon material now, because too many people, what was that, 1978? You don't want to alienate your audience. And who knows, maybe they were all a black Mormon audience and I didn't know it, and that was my racist perception of the whole thing. But I figured I want to make friends with the audience. So I did this. And this is, if any of you find yourselves doing stand-up in an urban setting, don't do this. And actually, I'm curious. If any of you, I wanted to do a call and response thing. And so, if any of you actually know the response to this, and if you do, this will be really cool. Just, you'll know when to shout stuff back. And also, just so you'll know, in this, the term Dick is an abbreviation for Detective and Richard as well. But it's also obscene slang in many places, but we're not using it that way. It's short for Detective. Keep that in mind. So I told the audience, I said, I have a question for you, and please answer it for me. When you get some time, I said, who is the black private Dick, sex machine to all the chicks? Damn right. See, but it's Shaft. That's the theme from Shaft there. But a famous 70s blaxploitation film. And perhaps the first, it was very influential. But I'm there, and I asked that question. I didn't even get that one guy in the back.
Shaft?
Nothing. They're just like, what on earth are you doing? And then and then like somebody goes, is it Michael Jordan? And so that bit bombed, and I had to actually recite to them the lyrics of an Isaac Hayes song that they didn't know. It won the Oscar in 1974, people. And no one knows it anymore. So that's why I'm so thankful to be with you all here today. When you knew the theme from, what's your name, sir? You. Who's staff? Yeah, you.
Chris.
Thank you, Chris. You've made my day. And one of the big laws of humor is you're supposed to leave on a big laugh. The other rule is, barring that, leave. So that's what I'm going to do. Thank you very much. This is me responding to what you just heard. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Matt and Ed for this hour of mirth. We have, 10 minutes if anybody's interested in questions. We have some experts here on what you've just heard. So, please.
Will the position of ward humorist be a correlated position?
The question is, will the position of ward humorist be a correlated one?
I don't know the answer to that. Someone else asked me once if you have a temple recommend. Have to wait for there's a manual that's coming out.
I think
out.
You need an exempt recommend. Like an something exempt recommend. Like some kind of a, I would think you'd need some kind of like a, you can get a special use recommend. I would imagine there'd be
for the dead.
Yeah, something like that. But I'm thinking there would probably be a designation like a, we'll let you get away with a little bit more and keep it, because you're, you know, humor, dangerous. Thank you.
Chase.
I have an opposite than that. I know we don't have gongs and directors, floor directors in our wards yet, but you're welcome to borrow my 4-year-old son, who's been known to yell out in sacrament meetings. When is he going to stop talking now?
Do you encourage him to do that? You do. You don't punish him, do you?
Just repeating the comment, someone who offers Although they didn't have a gong, they do have a 4-year-old son who will yell out, "When is he going to stop talking, Mom?" Chris?
I was going to suggest on the idea of the voucher that possibly some married people need that also. But anyway, on the testimonies and the animals, just my niece does a great bit, but she swears that she heard it in a meeting and sat through it, where the lady got up and started crying because she came home and her dog had eaten her Book of Mormon. And she said, brothers and sisters, then I realized every day when I come home, I hear into it too, and he was just hungry. I swear it's a true story.
I'm supposed to report for the tape. Yeah, summarizing, we have a sister whose dog ate into the Book of Mormon, and when she realized, well, she tears into the Book of Mormon too, because the dog was just hungry for the Word of God. There was no problem. Oh, well, moving right on, please.
I was going to say, even better than a gong system would be in the old days in vaudeville, where they had a shepherd's hook and just pulled it right off the stage.
Trap door.
Yeah, the shepherd's hook is what we all wish for. Did anybody ever have like a Brother Adams that did the prayer for 45 minutes? An hour and a half prayer. Oh, congratulations.
That don't work.
There's another question over here.
Please.
Have you done any studies on the podium for General Conference where the brother is speaking? They have a light system where it's yellow, red, and green, like in Congress, where their speakers may warm.
McGraham Richards used to say there was such a thing. He'd be up there planted on the podium like this, and he'd like stop and say, "All right, red light again," and then he'd try to talk for longer. So apparently they have something. Or maybe the teleprompter goes blank.
Yeah. See, but it'd be my point that, like, you know, that if the general authorities time their talks, and why can't we? That's all I'm saying. What more spiritual than a general conference, huh? Time them, kids. Time them.
Any further input? Chris.
It's not humorous, but it brings a good point. I always notice that when singers sing at church, they practice several times, and that's considered, spiritual preparation. But if a speaker is actually to practice his talk, he'd be a worldly apostate. Only if you're totally unprepared are you considered spiritual.
And in fact, however, it is widely known, or it was widely. I had a friend on the inside in Salt Lake. Somewhere back near the tabernacle or underground in the labyrinth of time, there's actually like a podium with teleprompters.
Two of them.
You see? All right, there we go. Two of them. Where, I mean, where clergy go and practice their talks and practice reading off the teleprompter. Amen twice, Chris.
One more response to that. I understand that she was giving a talk at BYU. They stood up and said, "I prepared a word today. I've got the scriptures. I'm going to open up and God will tell me what I'm supposed to do and say." He opened up the scriptures and it said, "And Judas and hanged himself." And he said, let me try again, And then he flipped the pages and it said, "Go and do thou likewise."
I suppose that is the way to end the session. As Matt says, with a big laugh, or just get out. So we're out of here. Thank you very much.